Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 20. During the long drive home, my mortification about the way I'd deceived Douglas DeWitt's mother initially obliterated all my thoughts about what I'd learned. What kind of a lowlife would lie to such a nice person with a broken leg? As if that weren't bad enough, it seemed a safe bet that Ms. DeWitt would share news of her fantastic interlude with the great Dr. Upton with her son, if I were so unlucky that he should call home. That seemed so likely as to be a done deed. And if Douglas DeWitt shared news of my visit with the meticulous Chandler McCarthy, I'd be in for a big-time cookie-baking lecture for sure. In spite of all that, by the time I arrived home, I knew I had to learn more about the elusive Rottweiler, regardless of his owner's relationship with my sometimes partner. Granted, both Nick Cooper and Ms. DeWitt made it quite clear he's a wonderful dog, I informed the assembled pets who watched me preparing my tea. But how come he's never around, and no one ever mentions good old Devil by name? Teresa wore such a grave expression when I expressed these concerns, it spurred me to continue. Shouldn't even the most inexperienced criminal investigator wonder why something other than mere coincidence caused a Rottweiler and his owner to show up at home, covered with blood, the day Monica died? I asked the old dog. And why drive all the way to Massachusetts to have a routine but very bloody injury like a lacerated ear repaired? By then my tea was ready, and I took it and the animals outdoors. But Ms. DeWitt did say that the dog may have pulled his stitches out during the trip, I reminded myself as I surveyed the flowers for spent blossoms and sipped the refreshing peppermint tea. And that certainly had been known to happen. I watched Maddie slink through the columbines toward a patch of bright pink impatiens, where two male hummingbirds dive-bombed each other in an attempt to settle a territorial dispute. "Well, if that's the case," I announced loudly enough to alert the hummers and cause the cat to glare at me contemptuously, "I'll soon find out." I retreated into the house and called Tony's as well as all the other veterinary practices within a 30-mile radius of Somerset Lake. None of them had treated a Rottweiler with a torn ear belonging to Douglas DeWitt. I spent much of the next day doing the kind of work that paid the bills, but which I had allowed to pile up since Monica Sonko's death. But although I tried to give the task my full attention, thoughts of Douglas DeWitt and his dog kept interfering. As the clouds began to thicken outdoors and I found myself emailing a client that cutting his finicky poodle's ears might improve the animal's behavior, I put my serious work away and turned to the more deadly. When I did, the same niggling thought that had plagued me on and off throughout the day immediately resurfaced. Even if logic argued against finding any, I had to go back to the cottage and look for evidence of another dog. And I had to find it before the approaching storm destroyed it, even if it meant hunting for it in the dark. By the time I tended the animals, donned my dark detecting ensemble, collected my criminal tools just in case I might need to do a little breaking and entering, and drove to the lake, a heavy layer of clouds had darkened the evening sky considerably. As I carefully wove through the potholes in the road that paralleled the lake shore, I recalled how McCarthy had hidden his vehicle during his illegal escapade. Even though I felt somewhat uneasy appropriating any technique he used, he did have that in-depth knowledge of the criminal mind that I most surely hadn't gained in my work as a veterinarian. Thus reassured, I edged a sob into a thicket of evergreen shrubs, then congratulated myself when I could only see one blue fender from the road. However, hiding the car meant I had to travel the last mile to Joe's cottage on foot, and I set off at a brisk trot in that direction in the rapidly waning light. While I jogged, I devised a plan to systematically investigate the area for evidence of a second dog as quickly as possible, assisted only by my high-powered penlight. This so engrossed me that it came as quite a shock to see a small light already moving inside the cottage when I trotted down the driveway toward it. My apprehension increased even more when I saw no evidence of Joe's vehicle. After concealing myself behind a large blue spruce, I contemplated this unexpected turn of events as I observed the light's path. Someone was going through the cottage room by room. This awareness produced a paradoxical effect on me. Part of me, the rational thinking part, told me to get the hell out of there as quickly as possible. The other, possibly insane part, told me I had to know who was in that cottage and why. Unfortunately, the latter part won. As I crept toward the cottage, I immediately realized that if I hoped to see anything at all, it would have to be through the broad expanse of glass at the back of the structure or the window beside the front door, both relatively exposed positions. I opted for the latter because the rhododendron in front of that window would offer the most cover, and even that wasn't very much. After quietly inching up the plank steps to the front door, I leaned over the wooden railing and peered through the shrub into the dark interior of the cottage. Just as I despaired of seeing anything, a glow on the wall indicated that the trespasser was finally moving in my direction. Soon I could see a small circle of light moving through the room in a combination of broad sweeps, followed by careful inspections of anything that caught the intruder's attention for some reason. Whoever it was definitely seemed to be looking for something specific, and judging from the deliberate way the light was moving, it wasn't the first time he'd been in there. Once my eyes grew accustomed to the dimness, I shifted my attention from the light to the person holding it. As far as I could tell from my awkward position, the trespasser was of average height and wore dark, form-disguising clothing, not what I considered a very useful description. "Come closer, you sleazeball," I silently berated the miscreant whom, I admit, I secretly admired for his ability to break and enter with such apparent ease. The miscreant obeyed, but it gained me little. Now I could see that something had been wrapped around a standard-sized flashlight to either shield or focus its beam. What few rays escaped through the makeshift shield's edges barely illuminated a narrow strip of the hand holding the light. I muttered a few hushed epithets, then froze when I realized how remarkably still and oppressive the night had become, the proverbial calm before the storm. Unfortunately, the calm was a lot shorter than I anticipated, because the railing produced what sounded to me like a deafening moan when I leaned over it even more to get a better view. The beam suddenly jerked upward in my direction. When it did, I saw a second, lower, much smaller, and more brilliant flash that instantly shot one explosive thought into my head. "Gun!" I yelped in surprise, leaped backwards, tumbled down the steps, righted myself, and fled into the woods. Once in the woods, I stopped. The increasingly humid air surrounding me like a thick, dark chamber that magnified the sound of my pounding heart enormously. I heard the front door open, a soft sound like that of a snake uncoiling. He was coming after me. I moved away from the cottage as quickly and quietly as possible, but it seemed like every sound echoed ominously around me. And even though I saw or heard nothing that would indicate that someone pursued me, I couldn't get the image out of my mind. Once it took hold, my movements became even more measured and controlled as I attempted to move as silently as my real or imagined pursuer. When the anticipated gunfire didn't cut me down as expected, a second, more terrifying image replaced the first. A killer dog. Unlike guns, about which I knew nothing, this image elicited the raw fear that comes from intimate knowledge. Unlike a person, a dog would have the dark, adapted, motion-sensitive vision, ultrasonic hearing, an incredible olfactory and tactile senses that would enable it to move more easily through this dark woodland than I could on the brightest day. No matter how powerful a weapon the person in that cottage carried, he needed to get close enough to me in the dense vegetation to use it. For a dog, that posed no problem. A dog was so good at that, it didn't even need a weapon. The dog was the weapon. I froze mid-stride, paralyzed by the thought that there was no way I could possibly move undetected if a dog rather than a person pursued me. I had to know what was following me. Whatever the risk involved, it was nothing compared to the folly of responding to a killer dog as if it were a killer human. With hands trembling so badly that I could hardly hang on to my penlight, I scanned the blackness around me with a tiny, high-powered beam. This time, I saw two flashes instead of one. Animal eyes. You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.